here this morning. Hope you'll get a Bible out and look with us at a few things in the Scriptures that I hope will challenge us and encourage us and remind us of the things that are most important in life. I want to begin with a very brief verse at the very end of the letter of 1 John in the New Testament. It's 1 John chapter 5, verse 21. This is John's ending to this little letter that covers so much ground so briefly. Talks about a number of different things. In 1 John 5 and verse 21, at the conclusion of this letter, John writes this, "Little children, guard yourselves from idols." That's interesting because John says pretty much nothing about idolatry in the rest of the book, and yet his conclusion is a reminder, "Little children, guard yourself from idols." Why did John need to say that? Because of so much of what we read in both Old Testament and New Testament history. In Exodus chapter 20, when God gave what we commonly call the Ten Commandments to the people of Israel, the first two of those read as follows. Verse 3 of Exodus 20, "You shall have no other gods before me." Verse 4, "You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments." Those two commandments, those first two of the famous ten, address on some level the worship of false gods. First, God saying that He would tolerate no other gods in His presence among the Israelites. And second, that they must not invent for themselves graven images that they would worship and serve. And I think that emphasis must have come from foresight, because as we turn the pages of Old Testament history, idolatry is one of the most persistent sins among the Israelite people. Over and over, in every generation, they seem to struggle with it. Even at Mount Sinai, right here where they're receiving the law, we turn over a few chapters to Exodus chapter 32, and what do we find? We find that as Moses is delaying in his stay up on the mountain, communing with God, the people get restless. They come to Aaron and they ask him to make gods for them to worship. And Aaron folds under the pressure and makes golden calves for them. In the days of the judges, we're studying the judges period, really just got into that this week in our Bible classes. And over we see repeating a pattern of the Israelites falling into idolatry, imitating the religious systems of the nations around them and the peoples that they had allowed to remain in the land of Canaan beside them, and it becomes a constant snare to them. In 1 Kings chapter 11, we read about Solomon in his old age. Solomon, righteous, wise Solomon. But in 1 Kings chapter 11, we read of how Solomon multiplied wives, and in his older years, wanting to accommodate those wives, began building idolatrous shrines for them to accommodate the gods of their homelands that they had grown up worshiping. And may, the text suggests, even have gotten involved in idolatry himself. And as a result of that, the kingdom was to be divided. And speaking of that, from its very division in both Israel in the north and Judah in the south, idolatry was a problem. In Israel, in the north, Jeroboam, the very first king of that divided kingdom of Israel, built golden calves at Dan in the far north and Bethel in the far south of his territory, and invited the people to come worship at those places instead of going down to Jerusalem to worship at the temple. That appears to have persisted through all of the northern kingdom's history, reaching its worst level under King Ahab and his Phoenician wife Jezebel. In fact, in 2 Kings chapter 17, where the inspired writer describes how Israel was carried off into captivity by the Assyrians, it is their idolatry that is cited in verses 17 and 18, verses 7 through 18, as the primary cause of the northern kingdom's destruction. In the southern kingdom, it wasn't a whole lot better. In Judah, beginning with Rehoboam, Solomon's own son, idolatry began to flourish, and flourished under all but 8 of Judah's 20 monarchs. Most of Judah's rulers did evil in the sight of the Lord, and specifically the evil they did involved the worship of idols. Much of the prophetic material in the Old Testament deals with idolatry, especially in books like Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Hosea. I want to spend just a moment looking at a couple of examples. First, from the book of Isaiah. This is Isaiah chapter 44. This is Isaiah chapter 44. We're going to read beginning in verse 15. Isaiah 44. In verse 15, the prophet says, the prophet is talking about a man cutting down a tree. That sounds innocuous enough, doesn't it? He started talking about that a few verses back. But then he says in verse 15, it becomes something for a man to burn, and so he takes one of them and warms himself. He also makes a fire to make bread. So far, so good. Legitimate uses of the wood that he cut. He also makes a god and worships it. He makes it a graven image and falls down before it. Half of it he burns in the fire. Over this half he eats meat as he roasts a roast and is satisfied. He warms himself and says, I am warm. I have seen the fire. But the rest of it he makes into a god, his graven image. He falls down before it and worships. He also prays to it and says, deliver me, for you are my God. You see the ridiculousness of idolatry that Isaiah is trying to emphasize. Somebody cuts down a tree, he cuts the wood, half of the wood he uses to make a fire, to warm himself and to cook his food over, and the other half of that same tree that he cut down, he fashions into a god and prays to it for deliverance. The prophet was trying desperately to get the people to see the foolishness of their decision to turn to idolatry. Chapter 45 of Isaiah, verse 20. Gather yourselves and come, says God. Draw near together, you fugitives of the nations. They have no knowledge who carry about their wooden idol and pray to a God who cannot save. Just a few pages over, near the beginning of the book of Jeremiah, Jeremiah chapter 2 and verse 27. Here's Jeremiah talking to the people of Judah. Jeremiah 2, verse 27, who say to a tree, you are my father, and to a stone, you gave me birth. They have turned their back to me, to God, and not their face. But in their time of trouble, they will say, arise and save us. But where are your gods which you made for yourself? Let them arise if they can save you in your time of trouble. For according to the number of your cities are your gods, O Judah. We could be here all morning citing examples from the prophetic literature, talking about the idolatry of the people of Israel and the people of Judah that ultimately led both of those nations into exile. But it's also prevalent in New Testament times. In Romans chapter 1 and verse 23, Paul, writing about the pagan Gentile world among which his readers lived, he says they exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and of four-footed animals and crawling creatures. You could go just about anywhere in the New Testament world and encounter the trappings of idolatry. And what's interesting is that some of the most famous artifacts that we have from that era were originally part of idol worship. And so we see pictures like some of these. You may recognize at least the building in the middle. That's the Parthenon in Athens. That's a famous structure. It's an architectural marvel, but sometimes we forget that it was a temple to the goddess Athena. She's pictured at lower left. On the far right side, you see the kind of pillar that might have dotted, say, an open marketplace. Say the marketplace that we find Paul in Athens in Acts chapter 17. One writer said, you would pass by these pillars everywhere you went, a veritable forest of idols. And upper right, you see household gods and goddesses that people had in their homes that they revered and offered prayers to. In other words, idolatry was a fundamental part of life for a lot of people, most people, living in the New Testament era. Paul found Athens in Acts chapter 17 and verse 16 full of idols. One writer of satire at the time complained that it was easier to find a god in Athens than it was to find a real man. In Corinth, the temple of Aphrodite, that's the Greek equivalent of Venus, housed, according to one ancient historian, at one time 1,000 sacred temple slaves and sacred prostitutes, because very often prostitution, sexual immorality, was involved in the worship, particularly of goddesses of love or fertility. At Ephesus, the temple of Artemis, or Diana, was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, as one writer compiled his list. And in Acts 19, we find Paul preaching at Ephesus, and his preaching led to a riot that was induced by the silversmiths who made their living fashioning little images of Artemis and selling them to people to keep in their homes. He was putting them out of business because he was converting so many people away from idolatry. The point is that it was everywhere you went. It was in the air you breathed. Whether people believed in these gods or not, they still worshiped them as a matter of social propriety. It was considered weird and rude not to offer a pinch of incense or other sacrifice to this god or that goddess at the appropriate season. That helps us understand some of the difficulties that the New Testament writers focus on in writing to Christians living in those kinds of environments. In the book of Revelation, chapter 9 and verse 20, speaks of men who worship demons and the idols of gold and of silver and of brass and of stone and wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk. No wonder when we get to the end of that little letter of 1 John in chapter 5 and verse 21, he concludes by saying, little children, guard yourselves from idols. Now, we may laugh here in 21st century America when we think about people praying for salvation and prosperity to statues of wood or stone or metal. Only the most primitive and backward cultures do stuff like that, right? Perhaps we need to rethink it. Because modern sophisticated man still can have his idols. They don't take the form of graven images. It's a different kind of idolatry than we find in the Scriptures. But it's made of inferior stuff nonetheless. I want to talk about that for a little while. I want to talk about the potential for idolatry that exists even in our modern world and how very easily we might succumb to it. Let's consider a few modern idols in the time we have left. There are folks who, I guess you could argue, have idols of wood and stone. I'm talking, in their case, about the environment. I don't want to be misunderstood in what I talk about here. But there are still folks in our world who seem almost literally to worship trees and rocks. They don't fashion them into anything anymore. There are some environmental activists who have pretty much elevated our planet to divine status. Some of them have even literally bought into Eastern religions that revere the earth as a goddess. I mention that not to say that the environment around us should be unimportant to us. In Genesis chapter 1, we read about how God created mankind to have dominion over God's creation. Dominion over every other living thing on earth. That's reiterated to Noah in Genesis chapter 9 and verses 1 through 3. In Psalm 8, David marvels at man's insignificance, and yet says you, God, have given him dominion over the work of your hands. We just sang about that a few moments ago. That dominion brings with it responsibility. Lawrence Osborne, in a book called The Guardians of Creation, said, "We are called to exercise dominion in the image of God. It follows that appropriate human dominion will be modeled on divine sovereignty, but our God is not a tyrant who delights in crushing his subjects underfoot. The implication is, neither should we be." Just picture it this way. Imagine that you're a talented artist. I have a lot of trouble imagining that. I don't know about you. But just imagine you're a really skilled painter and you craft a beautiful painting and you give it as a gift to someone you love and entrust it to their care and protection. And they turn around and use that beautiful painting as a doormat. You wouldn't appreciate that, would you? That's not good stewardship of what you have entrusted to them. "The earth is the Lord's and all it contains, the world and those who dwell in it," says Psalm 24 and verse 1. That is a reminder that we, given dominion over this creation, are stewards of what actually belongs to God. And that means, I think, by simple extension, that respect for our Creator means that we value and appreciate His creation. We do not abuse it. But ultimately, Christianity's focus is not on the earth or on animals, but on our relationship to God. And it is very easy, in the pursuit of wanting to protect that environment around us and be good stewards of it, that we elevate that environment to a status that gets more important to us than our relationship to God. I read just about every day of people who have done precisely that. They can get really upset about pollution, about global warming, whatever you may think about the climate change and our contributions to it or not. They don't get upset about sin. They don't get upset about alienation from God. That is our chief concern. We are created in God's image. We are unique among His creatures. We are created with an immortal aspect, a soul. Our nature and destiny are different from any other living thing, from any other created thing. It's easy to take something good, something noble that has been entrusted to our care, and allow it to become our God if we are not careful. And that is just as surely idolatry as if we were carving images and worshiping them. We have idols of flesh and blood. I'm talking about people. Celebrities in particular, stars of movies, music, television, sports, they have long been called idols. Maybe that's more true in some cases than we realize. In America, most of the time you'll find kids' bedroom walls covered with their pictures, their favorite athlete or their favorite actors or their favorite musicians. Celebrities are often named as spokesmen for various sensitive causes, not because of their expertise, but because of their public appeal. And consider the reactions that they sometimes get at public appearances. Even politicians sometimes. A Roman emperor would be jealous. And sometimes people throw all of their heart and soul into admiration of somebody. I want to be clear that there is nothing wrong that I can find with admiring someone's talents and abilities and contributions. Nothing wrong with applauding that. Nothing wrong, I guess, with wanting that person's autograph or cheering when you're in the crowd at one of their performances or one of their games. But we're talking about idolizing people. We're talking about elevating someone to a status where they occupy a place in my heart that is dangerous because it's a place where God belongs. This week, we learned of the death of Neil Peart, who was the drummer for the 70s and 80s progressive rock band Rush. Some of you don't care, I know, that's okay, just go with me for a minute. Peart was an exceptional musician, an exceptional songwriter. He made a lot of money, he gained a lot of fame, and he was always uncomfortable with one aspect of that when he would be interviewed. He was uncomfortable with the way people looked at him, the way people treated him. In one interview, he said, When I was a kid, I would go see a band in concert. It never occurred to me to find out where that band was staying and go down there and bang on their hotel room door or stand outside the room screaming. He had had people do that in his case. It made him uncomfortable. Now, Pierce was no Christian, but he saw something unhealthy in that. We should too. But there's a danger even in idolizing other people. Let me ask a question. That person that you admire for their skill in music or art or politics or acting or whatever it is, you may admire and want to imitate that person's abilities and that person's contributions, and that's great. It's good to have role models, at least in that sense of the word. Do you really want to be like that person, though? How well do you know that person's character, and from what you know of it, do you really want to be like that? Because in America, at least, we have an awful lot of celebrities. Take your pick, athletes, musicians, people in the political world. We have people very often whose personal lives are a train wreck. Their lives are characterized sometimes by drug and alcohol abuse, failed family relationships, sexual immorality of all kinds, and all kinds of other things, perhaps. The fascination with such people shows you that the world values people very often not for who they are, but for what they can provide. And when they can't provide it anymore, they're no longer of any use. Young people, you need to remember that as you're developing your own life and as you're thinking about the people you want to influence you. But there's a danger even in idolizing people who are good people. I've seen people idolize preachers and elders in the church to a pretty unhealthy extent and decide that fellow can just say or do no wrong. That's dangerous. Paul sure didn't want people doing that with him. Look at what he writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, for instance. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, as he writes this letter to the Corinthian church, in chapter 1 and verse 12, the first thing he addresses is that some of the folks at Corinth were saying, I am of Paul, or I am of Apollos, or I am of Cephas, when they should have just been saying, I am of Christ. Paul writes, has Christ been divided? Paul wasn't crucified for you, was he? Or were you baptized in the name of Paul? He answered, no. And Paul returns to that theme several times in this letter to remind the Corinthians not to elevate him or Apollos or anybody else to a status that belongs only to the Lord Jesus. That essentially is idolatry. Now you need to be careful about it. Some folks have idols in pills and bottles. We're talking about drug and alcohol addiction. The Bible is really clear in its warnings about drunkenness. I think it's equally clear in the foolishness of messing around with alcohol in any quantity. But I'm talking right now about addiction, because we live in a world that's got plenty of people in it. People you know, maybe family members, maybe friends, maybe other folks that you know right now are struggling with this. They have allowed some substance to essentially become their God. Well, they may not have set out intentionally to do that. I very seriously doubt that they set out intentionally to do that, but that's where they've ended up. In 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 19, Peter writes this warning. 2 Peter 2 verse 19 says, by what a man is overcome, by this he is enslaved. I think that's a valuable principle for reminding us about the dangers of anything controlling our lives other than God. Paul writes in Romans 6 about being slaves to righteousness. That and that alone is where my slavery should lie. And Paul says, make no mistake, in Romans 6, you're a slave to something. It's either sin or it's righteousness. Slavery to sin comes in all kinds of forms. Slavery to what many sociologists have described as God in a bottle is just one of them. But it's a real and prevalent and dangerous form of idolatry for a lot of people in our world. Let me ask you, is there some substance you cannot get through the day without? And I'll leave it at that question. We have idols of paper and plastic. I'm talking about wealth. Many people build their whole existence around these gods. Their primary concern in any and every situation is this materially profitable for me? And wealth is revered, of course, because it can buy us a whole bunch of other idols that we like really well. Idols of wood and brick and stucco houses. Idols of steel and aluminum and fiberglass, the cars and boats that we like. Idols of fine fabric, the clothes that we wear. Idols of plastic and wire and buttons, all the electronic gadgets that fill our lives. None of those things are inherently bad. All of those things have the potential to become a god to us in some way, if that's what we make our life's pursuits all about. That's the warning. I don't have to be greed-obsessed and still worship those gods. There's kind of respectable worldliness, as Robert Harkrider used to put it, that can be found among disciples of Christ who are willing, in some cases, to do anything for the Lord and anything for each other until it starts to cut into their enjoyment of material things. And then that's where the line's drawn. And what's truly important becomes evident. The Bible warns us that material things ultimately don't satisfy. Do they have a place in our life? Well, of course they do. Is it wrong to possess them? Not necessarily. In Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 10, for instance, the wise man of the Old Testament writes that he who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. And in the New Testament, in Colossians 3 and verse 5, Paul refers to greed and calls it idolatry. In Ephesians 5 and verse 5, he calls the covetous man an idolater. Why would Paul say that? Because he knew the danger, even in a world in which literal idolatry was so prevalent. He also knew that a person could very easily make wealth. Money and all the things that money can obtain for me, that could become my god if I let it. In Luke chapter 12 and verse 15, Jesus said that a man's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses. He reminds us in Matthew chapter 6 in the Sermon on the Mount that our goal should be spiritual, that we should be about seeking first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, not constantly worried about providing for ourselves, or in the American case, it's not really providing for ourselves, it's enriching ourselves that we struggle with. Because most of us, even the poorest among us, have at this moment a standard of living that's been virtually unknown in human history, and that even right now, billions of people on this planet would love to have and don't. It's possible in our modern age to have what I'm going to call idols of here and there. I'm just talking about our regular daily pursuits. In Luke chapter 14, Jesus tells a parable. Begins in verse 16 of Luke chapter 14. I want to take a moment and read it. Luke 14, starting in verse 16. A man was giving a big dinner, and he invited many. And at the dinner hour, he sent his slave to say to those who had been invited, "Come, for everything is ready now." But they all alike began to make excuses. The first one said to him, "I have bought a piece of land, and I need to go out and look at it. Please consider me excused." Another one said, "I have bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm going to try them out. Please consider me excused." Another one said, "I have married a wife and for that reason I cannot come." And the slave came back and reported this to his master. And then the head of the household became angry and said to his slave, "Go out at once into the streets and lanes of the city and bring in here the poor and crippled and blind and lame." And the slave said, "Master, what you've commanded has been done, and there is more room." And the master said, go out into the highways and along the hedges and compel them to come in so that my house may be filled. For I tell you, none of those men who were invited shall taste of my dinner. Now that is a parable about God's invitation for people to enter His kingdom. And the point of it is that very often we are so busy with ordinary day-to-day pursuits that we don't even have time to respond to what is most important in life. And that is redemption from sin and fellowship with God. In this parable, those who were forbidden to taste of the great supper didn't commit any overt acts of sin. They were excluded over a piece of ground, over 5 yoke of oxen, over a new marriage. There are a lot of things in life with which there is nothing wrong. The day-to-day things that we get involved in, getting up, putting our clothes on, going to work, being involved in service clubs, being involved in community kinds of events, sports, music, whatever it is. Not a thing wrong necessarily with being involved in those things. In fact, they have a potential to really enrich our lives. The problem, one of the great challenges of discipleship, is not just keeping from immorality. It is keeping 1,001 basically good things from taking over our lives and crowding out God, excluding Him from the throne of our hearts where He belongs. And it is really easy to let that happen. We are a busy society. Maybe one of the busiest ever to dwell on the face of this earth. And sometimes that keeps us from serving God. Sometimes that busyness, in essence, becomes our God. And that is idolatry just as surely as if we were bowing down to some graven image. It's just of a different sort. But the end result is the same. Makes no difference to the devil. Idolatry, you see, isn't really dead. And it's not just limited to primitive cultures in far-off lands. It is alive and well even in advanced Western society. The gods may be different. We don't even call them gods. But the temptation to worship them, in essence, is very much the same. Our idols are whatever we allow to take control of our motives and our decisions, our priorities, and our actions where God should be. No wonder John said to his readers, little children, guard yourselves from idols. And I think that would be a fitting conclusion for our thoughts today. Would you turn your psalm book to the number Scott announces our invitation song? Writing to the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians 1 and verse 9, Paul remarked on how those people had turned to God from idols to serve the living God. What we're inviting you to do is essentially the same thing. Because if you're not a Christian, it means that something up to now has occupied first priority in your heart and mind, and God is the one who belongs in that position. So what we're inviting you to do is to leave behind whatever those idols are and turn to the living and true God. If you're ready to do that this morning, that's why we're going to sing this song, so we can hopefully encourage you to make that decision, the decision to commit your life to Jesus Christ in faith, in repentance, and in obedience to Him by being baptized into His death this morning and raised to walk in newness of life. Are you ready to do that? Then if you are, then come forward as we stand, as we sing this song together.